Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside editor Simon Lambert and me today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And this week, retail empires came crashing down as the ghosts of Christmas past, present and future stalk the high street. Tens of thousands of jobs are on the line as some of the biggest names in fashion go to the wall. Could more follow? We take a look at the lay of the land and where we're heading, while Lee issues a warning to festive shoppers. While physical shops may struggle, no such problems online. Our addiction to the internet reached record levels this weekend. Will it ease off now lockdown is over? Or is this a trend that's here to stay? Plus today, why doing up your house can be a flipping good idea, but only if you get it right, and pensions are rubbish. Right? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, a crisis at Christmas. Tens of thousands of retail jobs could go following the crash of two retail empires and the loss of one of the high street's oldest occupants. As staff were preparing to come back to work after lockdown, we got the news first of the collapse of Sir Philip Green's Arcadia Group. That includes the likes of Topshop, Topman, Miss Selfridge and Dorothy Perkins. Then Philip Day's Bon Marché followed after his other chains, Edinburgh Woolen Mill, Peacocks and Pundon Home Stores, also fell into administration last month. And in between all of that was the news that a proposed rescue deal by JD Sport for Debenhams had fallen through, leaving the department store to be liquidated. Goodness. Welcome to you both. Firstly, I feel, as I'm sure you both do, for the staff, any staff affected by this at the moment, hope jobs can be found elsewhere and quickly. A troubling time for staff, troubling time for the high street. Lee, welcome. What happened? Are these events linked? Was it coronavirus, or was it coronavirus the straw that broke the camel's back, or is it nothing to do with that?
I think in part it's down to coronavirus, Georgie. I don't think it can be solely to blame. I think it's just accelerated the death of some of these shops, unfortunately, quicker than potentially they might have. And actually, you know, maybe they would have survived if there wasn't a pandemic. But, you know, you have to look at Arcadia and Debenhams as two examples of retail victims of online. You know, a lot of people now are used to fast fashion, use websites like Boohoo, Pretty Little Thing, all of those kind of popular places. And it feels like they didn't adapt quick enough to those new challenges, the new kids on the block, so to speak. It feels like they should have shifted quicker into seeing that that's where the market was heading, in my opinion. As you say, 25,000 jobs looking likely to be lost between Debenhams and the Arcadia shops. Debenhams really looks like it is, going to disappear, which is a shame. You know, it's been a department store for almost 250 years on the British High Street, 250 years of history. Just like that, there was a takeover bid from JD Sports. It was the last sort of company that had its name in the ring to take it over, and it didn't do that. And I'm sure there'll be people up and down the country when they think about Debenhams and they think about the Arcadia brands, Topman, Topshop, Burton. You know, they'll have their own stories of why they think things might have gone wrong. I've certainly got my own stories to tell why I think that these shops just didn't do what they needed to do to survive. And they've gone the way of other big brands of the last decade or two, Woolworths, BHS, you know, all of these historic shops are just gone, partly online, shift online, partly other things. And I worry about the future of the high street, Georgie. I mean, what's it going to look like soon with all of these shops, department stores disappearing? We've got all of these out-of-town retail units. I don't know, it doesn't look good. It doesn't drive me to want to go into the high street anymore.
I just want to pick up on what you said about Boohoo and Pretty Little Things. How can you compete with that sort of fast fashion, very cheap product online unless we get, Simon, sort of a Google tax type thing that's been proposed?
Well, I mean, firstly, it's worth noting that a company such as Boohoo or ASOS, both are British-based companies and both have British-based tax bills. And as far as I'm aware, neither of those companies do anything like shoving money into other countries. They don't do the double Dutch sandwich or whatever it's called, where you start shuffling money around low tax areas. But I think more to the point is you can compete if you are a traditional bricks and mortar retailer. And you have to compete. You have to decide to compete. Because if you don't decide to compete, you're done. Now, there is one successful retailer that doesn't really have an online presence, and that's Primark. Yeah, Primark's, you know, unique selling point is that kind of cheap fashion clothes. It's not really a unique selling point, but it's a selling point. But people love it, you know, the old Primarni joke kind of thing. Now, Primark has been absolutely walloped by the fact that we've been in lockdown and stores have been shut. Primark, however, is part of a bigger group, Associated British Foods. And the other side of Associated British Foods basically does food and stuff like that. So Primark can kind of get away with it because it's got another part of the business that can support it through the lean times. But if you look at Arcadia and if you look at Debenhams, there's one thing that runs through both of those stories. And then there are two separate things going on there in terms of online, because Debenhams had a decent online offering. Maybe it was a bit late to the party, but it had a decent online offering. And in fact, you couldn't get onto Debenhams' website yesterday, the day before, to get in and get into the fire sale that they were having of stuff. People were queuing to get onto the website. Arcadia and Topshop, on the other hand, you know, they never really went with the digital stuff. Now, I'm going to read the start of a column from someone who writes for a competitor to us, The Guardian, Larry Elliott, I do like Larry Elliott and his writing. And his column says, Philip Green wasn't much cop at capitalism. That may sound a strange way to describe a very wealthy man who lives on an ocean-going yacht moored in the tax haven of Monaco. It perhaps sounds doubly weird, given that Arcadia consists of some of the best-known names on the high street, Topshop, Wallis, Miss Selfridge, Dorothy Perkins among them. But even a halfway decent capitalist should have seen that the writing was on the wall for large swathes of traditional bricks and mortar retailing years ago. Green was unaware of or indifferent to this week's collapse of Arcadia and the wrenching structural change in his own industry. Now, the point is, Philip Green just basically was not that interested in online. Famously, doesn't like technology, doesn't like online. As far as he was concerned, you know, his brands were good enough to see it through. And they weren't. So if you look at a rival, for example, that was very strong in bricks and mortar retailing, Next is a well-run business, and people there went, okay, so we need to do something about this. Obviously, they had the old Next Directory thing, which, you know, helped them out. But, I mean, that was a paper-based catalog. Does that give you that much advantage in switching to online sales? Not really. But Next is profitable. Next is doing well. Next's online offering, you know, is a success. Whereas with Arcadia, it wasn't. Now, what's the thing that runs through Arcadia and runs through Debenhams? Debt. Big, big piles of debt. The way that private equity money and debt and refinancing and financial engineering was used and was very much on trend through the 2000s to load up companies with debt and pull money out of them, and many people enrich themselves. Philip Green's wife got herself a £1.2 billion dividend from Arcadia at one point. Now, a lot of this stuff that's gone on and a lot of companies that eventually go bust, it's the debt that gets them. It's the fact that they've got to be meeting the payments on those debts. And so when times are tough and the money's not coming in, they start to run the risk of breaching the covenants on their loans and so on and so on. You know, a lot of them have done sale and lease backs on their stores. So whereas once they would have had a property empire to rely on and that they would have only been paying rent to themselves, they sold off the stores and then they rented them back from other people. And when things are going swimmingly and when this is all going very well and you're paying yourself, you know, huge dividends and massive salaries and buying yachts and all that other stuff, it's great. But when stuff starts to turn down, you've got a problem. And debt has sunk high street chain after high street chain after high street chain, which are unfortunately dealing with the structural change in how we buy things. And so it's not only really difficult for them to keep up and challenge the online competitors who are capital light, the Boohoos, the ASOS and everything. But let's face it, Boohoo and ASOS spend an absolute fortune in sending stuff out to people and then getting returns back. In fact, ASOS's profits were massively boosted in lockdown because people sent less stuff back. So they do have their own challenges to face. But if you've got that on one hand, you're a high street retailer and you're trying to battle that. And on the other hand, you've also then loaded yourself up with debt. So you've got, you know, the wolves at the door kind of thing. You've got a real problem. And unfortunately, where this leads to is a load of people losing their jobs, a lot of them before Christmas, which is really unfortunate. And sort of the hollowing out of the high street as more and more names disappear. But to be honest, a lot of high streets have seen those names disappear anyway. High Street Kensington by our office, Topshop vanished a long time ago from its spot there. It's a big change and it's been massively accelerated, I think, by lockdown and everything we've seen this year. You know, maybe we've seen 3 years worth of change in 6 or 7 months.
It's interesting what you say about Next, because I wasn't a very big Next shopper. But recently, probably because I live near a very big Next, but I noticed that they've selling lots of other brands, famous brands, you know, Mint Velvet, Jules, Fat Face, all these sort of other high street brands being sold on the Next website. So it's not just about doing your own products very well online. It's also about integrating others. They seem to be doing this quite smartly, Lee. So actually, if you do it well, you can be success. I say this now, they're going to go under next week, aren't they?
Georgie, you've just described what Debenhams did. It had all concession stands, you know, in different brands inside a Debenhams department store, and that's not gone well, has it? But no, I do know what you mean. I do know what you mean with Next. We actually popped into a Next just before lockdown, and you know, having a young daughter, noticed there was all sorts of different kid brands in there, like quite high end kid brands, and they were being sold off for really quite low prices.
So then, what's the difference, Lee? If it isn't related to that, then why is it that Next is seemingly doing very well and they've made that choice? I don't know how long they've been doing this, other brands within their own name. But why would you choose to do that if you're looking across at Debenhams? I think, didn't BHS do the same thing?
Yeah, it's slightly different though, isn't it? As in Debenhams, you know, would have an actual proper shop of like different brands inside. Whereas I think what Next, doesn't Next have Choices, which is like a kind of discount, gets stock. I'm guessing it's stock that hasn't sold in shops that's last seasons or whatever, and people that don't care like me just snap it up exactly for a cheaper price. But let me tell you just a really, really quick brief story about Debenhams. Me last year, right? So I got married last year. I was after a suit and I was after suits for the ushers. Someone said to me, go to Debenhams. They'll sort you out at a pretty good price. You know, it's pretty easy. So I did that. I turned up. I booked a slot. They kept me waiting for about 20 minutes. This young lad finally sort of showed up. I'll be frank with you, he didn't care less. And it was just a completely rubbish experience. And that was, you know, £1,000 potentially of suit hire, you know, 800 to £1,000. That's a massive amount of money that I could have potentially spent at Debenhams. But I was so wound up from being left waiting and the fact that it was just such a rubbish experience. I don't think I ever went back in Debenhams after that. And that would have been like sort of last January, February time. You know, and it's just things, there's little things like that that I don't understand how that is so, why that would be so complicated. And then let me tell you about a high street shop that I think is doing really well, Jules. I think Jules is a really good high street shop. It sent us a Christmas card this week, a personalised Christmas card with my wife's name on it. It had a £10 voucher in there, said Merry Christmas. It has a great online presence and the shops are also a pleasant experience. The staff are very helpful, very friendly. That's an experience of where retail can get it right. Do you see what I mean? Like, you go into Debenhams, you go into Arcadia, you just feel like another sort of face going in to buy some stuff that no one really has much care or attention given to them. No, but actually, if you go in now, I think shops that are going to survive are strong brands like that. That Simon touched on it earlier. The USP. What is the USP of a shop if you're going into it? Is it because it gives good customer service? Is the quality of the clothes good? I think Next clothes are very good quality. So I do go into Next and buy a Next clothes because they're good quality. Primark, yeah, pop in there for some cheap bits and pieces for my daughter. Now, there's all these kind of things. Then you start to go to yourself, what's Debenhams' USP? It sells some luggage. But you know, I don't need luggage bags that often.
Maybe yeah, every sofas few on years. Perennial discount, I noticed.
Yeah, exactly. In order that, and then what's Top Man's USP? Well, it's literally got clothes for the under 21, so I'm you know excluded from that now. You know, and you go on and on and on about these shops, and I go back and think about Woolworths and what was Woolworths' USP? Pick a mix and CDs. Well, they started sending pick a mix cheaper at Wilko. And CDs just become basically obsolete in an age of streaming. So it's about these retail names keeping up and making sure that they've got their finger on the pulse and adapting if necessary. I think a lot of these companies just don't do it good enough.
I think personally Woolworths, the nail was stuck in the coffin for it with the demise of the cassette single. I think it peaked around about the cassette single era and then it was just downhill from there. I must say that with the department store thing, unless you're a really, really good department store, then there is an issue because basically the internet is just one big department store that you can visit, you know, in your house or on your phone, sat on your sofa or, you know, at your laptop. So unless you've got some kind of selling point for it, you are definitely gonna struggle and be eaten into, because that idea of, well, we'll pull all these different things together into one store and people can go buy, you know, X, Y, and Z in one go. It's like, well, I can do that from the comfort of my sofa, thank you very much. So yeah.
You know, obviously the job losses, we've spoken about that, but there's also other issues here as well. And Sir Philip Green and the pension black hole, you know, there's issues over pensions. But also in the wider context, you think about all the rent. So just expand it out, what it means if something like a Debenhams or a Topshop or something like that goes under. What is the fallout in terms of job losses, pensions, rent, and the wider high street? What does it matter if we're in this kind of issue with the high street?
Well, I mean, you're talking about tens of thousands of jobs that end up being affected. So, you know, 25,000 workers whose jobs are at risk at Arcadia and Debenhams. That's a lot of people, you know. You've then got the scenario where there's a knock-on effect, you know, suppliers not being paid. You've got the pension problem where do the pension schemes have to end up being rescued? Isn't an issue for any business that folds. It is a major drag, you know, on the economy. And then you maybe have one less shop on the high street that, or two less shops on the high street, makes it a bit less likely that people go to a certain high street, and that impacts on the other businesses. And we are obviously in a scenario at the moment where we've seen large job losses. We're projected to see those continue due to the effects of lockdown, coronavirus crisis, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a major dampener. And this is the reason why, you know, the Bank of England said that it expected the economy to contract in this quarter. It expects it to grow in the first 3 months of 2021, but it very much depends on what happens and how open the economy is. And this is where the argument comes from over, you know, economy versus lockdown versus coronavirus. Are we overreacting, you know, in our attempts to suppress the virus, or are we doing less than needs to be done? And we just need to keep borrowing the money and throwing it at the economy to keep it going. And that's a live debate, and the tactic so far has been to throw as much money as is humanly possible at it. And government is borrowing huge sums. Interest rates are very low. The interest it's going to pay on its debt is low. There might be a cautionary tale involved in the debt scenario with, you know, the shops, but a government is a very different scenario to that. And the British government, Britain has the advantage that it prints its own money, so we'll be all right for some time to go. But it's a very sort of sorry state of affairs. And yeah, I don't know. But as I said the other week, I'm quite optimistic, but I think the economy is going to pick up quite strongly once people start getting vaccinated and we start getting these restrictions out of the way. And I think there's going to be a big burst in spending despite all these drags on it. And I think that businesses that can survive this year and the first half of next year are going to be in a very good position to profit. And all of those people who I feel very sorry for who have lost their jobs will hopefully find themselves back in one soon enough and back on the up.
Absolutely. Talking about spending though, Lee, you've got a bit of a warning
Yeah, so a couple of years ago, I actually wrote a column about why I'm really not a big fan of gift cards and vouchers for shops and those experience days, you know, like track days, hotel stays, that kind of thing. So I kind of issued a warning a couple of years ago saying that I don't think they're a very good present. And I think this has really come into its own with the Arcadia collapse and with the Debenhams collapse. So number one reason why I'm not a big fan of them is because obviously a retailer can go under and you never quite, you think you can get a safe bet for a retailer, but I would have said Arcadia this time last year, really, would you have been thinking, it's in trouble. Yeah, okay, the debt issues, but the average consumer probably wouldn't really think about it. So it's one of those things, a gift card, gift voucher, people just like last minute Christmas panic buy, what can I get, you know, the nephew, the niece, whoever, or, you know, 50 quid, 20 quid voucher, whatever it is. Actually, all of gift vouchers, there's some, a study that's been done, are spent within a month. 50% of all gift vouchers are spent within 1 month. So people actually change their habits, I believe, and go, cool, I've got this gift voucher, I need to spend it like really quickly because other reasons. So they can go missing, they can expire, and they often do. And one of the big things for me is you get given a voucher. So I'd written this column because a couple of years ago, after my daughter was born, a lot of people got us mothercare vouchers, which is lovely. You know, I'm not turning down gifts. I'm not saying, God, what horrible people giving us gift cards. It's absolutely lovely. But you go into, went into mothercare, which of course has now gone under. And I got these vouchers. I've got to spend these ASAP because even at that time, it was like mothercare was in a bit of trouble. But you're in the shop and I'm looking at, you know, some baby monitors and I've got these gift vouchers to go towards it. And then I'm looking on my phone, as I do now in shops, and it's saying, you know, Argos, £30 cheaper. So what do? Do I go and spend the vouchers in mothercare because that's what we need? And pay 30 quid over the odds because it's not my money, or do I go and shop savvier? So it's those kind of things that kind of get to me. There's an environmental impact, Georgie. So when you use your debit card or credit card, you use it numerous times over the life of that card until it breaks, probably after a couple of years and they replace it for you. A lot of time gift cards, you know, PVC, you use it once, it gets binned away and it just ends up in a big pile. And lastly, I just think, give people cash. If you want, you know, to gift someone 50 quid, £20, you want them to spend £20 on some new clothes, you put £20 in a card if you're going to see them, or you back transfer it and you say, I'd really like you to go and spend this on some new clothes or on whatever you'd like, instead of restricting you into one shop where you might pay over the odds, that retailer may go bust and you're just going to want to use it ASAP so you don't lose it. They're all of my reasons. I don't want to see, and at least it can be a big revenue stream for some retailers. And obviously I want to, them to be supported as much as possible. Just don't think gift cards are the answer, personally.
Interesting. Cash seems a bit cold, doesn't it?
No, I want you to, I'm going to give you £50 and I want you to buy some clothes and I want a picture of you wearing the item.
That sounds a bit dodgy.
I hadn't thought of that one, Lee. What a big rain out. I do want to ask before we move on, just, you say, Simon, the ones that survive, there is all chance that there will be many that don't survive. You talked about debt, but we can't ignore the fact that with coronavirus, I don't know about you, but my family are already saying they're probably going to limit presents. We're not going to do the family get together because I've got a very big family where we normally exchange gifts. And I wonder if people will be tightening their belts. I know you said when this is over, people will go out and spend. Well, this is not over yet. So there may sadly be a lot of, particularly SMEs, that fall by the wayside. We have a pensions lifeboat. We're talking about a pensions black hole that I mentioned with Arcadia, 350 million. What does that actually mean for staff? And is it good enough to ride this out?
Well, what happens, and this is just in the example of a company going bust that has a final salary pension scheme. So if it's got a final salary or any form of defined benefit pension scheme, then that's the issue. If it's got a defined contribution pension scheme, then there's not really an issue because your money is invested into an investment account. Obviously, you're losing your job and you're not getting you're not going to get any more money paid in and so on and so on, but that money is yours. It's invested and it's yours. If it's a pension scheme, an old-fashioned pension scheme, a defined benefit pension scheme, then the pension trustees need to sort out what's going to happen And in the example where the pension scheme goes bust, then or couldn't pay out what it needs to, then it can potentially be picked up by the official lifeboat scheme, which is the pension protection fund. That will inevitably see many people suffer some cuts to their retirement income ultimately, because the pension scheme has promised to pay them a certain amount for every single year that they have worked for the company. If there is a black hole, then there might be some money paid in. There was talk of Tina Green paying some money into the Arcadia pension scheme, or there might be guarantees that they've already made. So for example, with Arcadia, 10,000 staff in the Arcadia pension scheme could be allowed to enter the pension protection fund if the company goes bust and it needs to go into it. What then happens is that they will get their what they were promised to be paid minus a certain amount. So staff who retired early or are still working will get 90% of what they were due. Okay. And this is subject, but this is subject to an annual cap, which is £41,461. For people aged 65, or £37,315 after the 90% level is applied. That sounds like an awful lot, but if you are someone who is an executive, for example, a senior executive, senior manager who has worked for their company for 40 years, there is a possibility that you could end up losing a considerable sum on your annual income. Now, some people might think, well, you're still getting plenty, but to be fair, you're owed quite a bit more. So there is a bit of an issue there for some people. For many people, it will be a 10% haircut, but for some, it will be more. If you have already retired and you're having your pension paid, then that is protected in its entirety. We've seen this happen on numerous occasions with different companies.
All right, well, we're going to leave that there. But what the physical high street may be struggling online, having no problems. And it's not just all our money we're spending online that I want to focus on, but our time. Last week, we set a new record in the UK for internet usage over a 24-hour period, known as Virtual Super Saturday. Lee, what happened? Why were we online so much? Was it all just down to lockdown? Or is this a trend that's here to stay as we all walk around with our faces in our mobile phones?
Can I just say, it's not known as Virtual Super Saturday. That is just something that I made up, thinking about the heady days of the 2012 Olympics. Me? And that's Super Saturday.
Own
but
it.
Yeah, no, we can call it. We can,
own
you know,
it.
I'll own it. I'll own it. That's fine. Yeah, so I had some data come through, some exclusive data from Talk To, who I spoke to, someone quite senior there, and we were talking about the sort of surge in internet use in the last sort of few months. Now, the 21st of November, so not last Saturday, but the Saturday before, it was a record 24 hours of internet usage, which TalkTalk saw from its customer base. And I won't bore you with all petabytes and gigabytes and all this kind of stuff, but what I will say is that usage was up a third compared to the Sunday before, and it was up almost 60% on some other Saturdays of the rest of the year. And there's two big factors behind this. One of the big reasons why that Saturday was so busy was the launch of the PlayStation 5. And we've also had the new Xbox come out in the previous week to that as well. Now, what's happened with those consoles? Back in the day when you used to get consoles, you used to have discs or cartridges to play games. And both PlayStation and Xbox now has a digital-only version for the first time. So for slightly less money, you can buy basically a PlayStation 5 or an Xbox that doesn't allow you to put physical games in it, aka you have to stream them over the internet. And that's what saw a massive spike as people were setting up their PlayStation 5s on the Saturday, downloading games. And some of these games are huge, George. You think about the details in it, the maps, all of this kind of stuff. It just saw people really put a massive, not a strain because they can cope with this kind of spike, but a huge spike compared to previous weeks. The other thing that's actually even bigger than that is our new habit of streaming TV and film. So again, not that long ago, you know, we used to watch DVDs, we used to go down Blockbuster, all that kind of stuff. You know, these days a lot of us have a streaming subscription or two or five. You know, there's a lot of people that juggle all of these subscriptions. Personally speaking, I've had in the last couple of months, Netflix, Amazon Prime, Now TV, quite often watch BBC iPlayer, watch 4 on Demand. You know, that's a lot of different things that I'm using to watch and stream TV and movies. And we expect it instantly now, Georgie. We don't want that little buffer wheel. We just want all of this stuff to be seamless. And that's what's happening. And there's been more investment into making that happen. I actually ditched Netflix for the first time a couple of weeks ago, having had it for probably at least 5 years, maybe more, just because I ran out of things to watch. And Now TV hooked me in with a free trial for a month and then $1.99 for 6 months. And it's brilliant. All of HBO shows, Sky Atlantic, all this kind of stuff. And of course, in a couple of weeks' time, I'll be getting that Sky Sports package on Now TV to watch the darts. So, you know, all of this kind of thing, you know, this is how a lot of our TV viewing habits have shifted. And it's almost like a streaming battle now to get customers in and all these companies in it. I think it is brilliant for the consumer. I think there's never been a better time to have all of these TV shows. Sometimes we have too much choice. And I think about the excitement of Channel 5 launching and all of that, and just having a few channels. Again, I'm not some old man. I'm only in my 30s, but I remember a very narrow choice. But all of these different things at our fingertips are just meaning that our internet usage just continues to go up and up. And the person that I spoke to at TalkTalk believes that this record will probably be smashed again over one of the days over Christmas when more people unwrap PlayStation 5s or their new Xboxes. And all of these things where you stream games, they also need constant software updates, again, that are streamed. A lot of us now, he was saying that there's an internet rush hour between 10 past 9 and 9:15 pretty much every day. And what it is people either surfing on the internet while watching normal TV in the adverts. Remember the old Coronation Street kettle spike where people used to go and stick the kettle on the National Grid?
You mean in the morning or the evening?
Late? In the evening. Oh, right. So in the evening, yeah, sorry, 9:15 p.m. And it's just that people loading up films and TV, and it's a really interesting set of data. And I think it's just something that will obviously continue to grow. And I've been rest assured that it can all cope with this, and it's continuous. They plan 2 to 3 years ahead, these internet providers. They look at how much growth they think they're going to need to keep up with the demand from the British public. And he's like, we're currently like somewhere in 2023, like seeing what that, if we're going to be able to, you know, making sure we're keeping up with the needs and that the needs are met. I think really interesting stuff.
In terms of investing, Lee made a good point there. In terms of things like Netflix and all that, well, actually, to be fair, you did think how many more people could you onboard? And apparently a global pandemic was what they needed. But, you know, it's not infinite. So in terms of investing, when you look at the internet companies, is now different. People have been burnt in the past. But actually, is this a trend that's here to stay? And what should you look out for if you are looking at investing in internet companies?
Okay, so with Netflix, for example, the shares are up massively this year. They're up something like, I think about, well, they're not up that much massively. Maybe they're up like 40%, 40-something percent year to date, okay, which is a huge amount in a year, especially when the share price has risen so much in the past. But actually, in the context of this year and some of the share price rises we've seen, it's not that big. But let's just work on the basis that roughly 40% share price rise is pretty huge, unless you're comparing yourself to Tesla or something. And they have been boosted hugely by the new number of subscribers. Now, Netflix is a good business in the sense that it has a subscription model. Once you start paying for it, you are quite likely to just continue paying for it for a very long time. Subscribers are notoriously sticky. You maybe get people in with a 1 month free trial and then they stick around for ages. As a man who has a Netflix, Amazon Prime and Now TV subscription, having signed up to them to watch various things and still has all of them after having intended to cancel almost all of those some time ago, I can tell you about how sticky subscriptions are, even if you know how sticky subscriptions are. The problem that Netflix has from an investment case perspective is that whilst it has revenue and it can turn that regular revenue and regular cash flow into profit. In order to keep getting subscribers, it has to spend a very large amount of money on content. Now, it has to either buy that content in, which is what it originally did, or it has to make that content, which is what it does an awful lot of now. Netflix, effectively, is, you know, one of the big studios now. It's gone from being, you know, capital light. We talked about earlier with the retailers online. It's gone from being a capital light subscription business, digital, where you watch stuff, to having to spend huge amounts of money commissioning people to make documentaries, drama series, films. Look at the number of films Netflix is making now. It's a major, major studio player. That eats into the money that you can make. And it also leads to an arms race, because Netflix isn't operating solo. Netflix is going up against people like Sky in this country. It's going up against Disney. It's going up against the other major studios. It's going up against all, it's going up against Apple making content. You know, it's going up against all these other people who want a slice of that pie and are all competing for it. So what happens when you have that? Well, you're paying for talent, right? And when you have talent and you have a lot of money sloshing around and you're chasing the talent, what does the talent do? The talent demands more money. So the actors, the producers, the developers, and it starts to cost more money to do things. I'll give you an exact comparison with this that was made to me by a fund manager I interviewed recently, Stephen Yu of the Blue Whale Growth Fund, who doesn't invest in Netflix but does invest in a lot of tech companies. He said, it's like football, basically. It's like the Premier League. Where does the money go? It goes to the players. However much money those clubs keep pulling in, they keep having to spend more and more and more on the talent in order to keep people watching and get and increase the number of people watching. So Netflix, personally, from that point of view, whilst I can see it's a good business, it's got recurring revenue from its subscriptions, and it's probably going to become even more important in the studio world, maybe it isn't such a great investment case. Whereas if you take something that is another digital business, you know, like a Facebook or something, well, Facebook doesn't pay anybody for any content. We make it all for free. I mean, it does pay some people for content now, but we create all the content that Facebook could ever possibly need for free. And then we create it all for Instagram as well. WhatsApp, we do that as well. We're creating all the content on WhatsApp. It doesn't even bother to monetize WhatsApp. So if you look at something like a compare Netflix to Facebook, you can go, well, maybe Facebook can just keep growing that revenue without it being eaten into by having to pay the talent. I mean, I think we're a long way away from Facebook paying us to post our photos on there, aren't we? So those are the things that you need to consider if you're investing in these things, not just whether the share price has gone up substantially over the past year.
Indeed. Simon, before I put this whole subject to bed, I have to ask you about Bitcoin, throwing it all together, online, investing, another roller coaster week. Where are we at now?
We hit a new all-time high for Bitcoin. It was a long time coming, but we finally got there. And the price of Bitcoin then promptly bounced downwards. It was an all-time trading high. Bitcoin, we normally speak about closing highs on the stock market, but Bitcoin never closes. It's a 24-hour game, 24/7, 365, Bitcoin's rolling. The crypto bros will be buying on Christmas Day and posting photos of themselves next to their Lamborghinis. It's at 18,978. At the moment, it cracked 19,000. I can't remember what the actual peak was. Apologies while I'm talking to you. Lee, do you know off the top of your head what the actual peak was? Oh, 19,768, I think. My computer is telling me as I'm talking to you now. Who knows what happens here? There was the expectation that it would hit that peak and then it would fall back down a bit. It's now what plays out in the months to come, whether it continues to fall back down as it did last time or whether it sort of stabilizes and then does another run up. I'm seeing a lot of crypto stuff at the moment, though, that's telling me the interest is definitely back on the rise in all of this stuff. If you do put some money into it, make sure it's only a very small part of your investable wealth and not money that you can't afford to lose, because you know, Bitcoin can move by even more than Tesla shares very quickly.
Goodness me. Well, talking about things that sort of defy belief, I suppose. House prices, my favourite subject. No, but this is more specific, actually. We're going to move on to that now because, I mean, who hasn't watched Homes Under the Hammer and thought, yeah, I could do that. Buy a home, yeah? No? Renovate it? Sell it for a big profit? Become a millionaire? It's called flipping. And the trend has hit a 12-year high, apparently. It can be a great idea as long as you know what you're doing. You do your homework, obviously, and you get it right. How do you get it right? But also there's a warning from experts. As property prices continue to soar, then the market may, shock, horror, overheat, and you could get very badly burnt. Lee, I don't know why, but I think you might be a Homes Under the Hammer fan. Am I right?
I am, Georgie. Yeah, I do love a bit of Homes Under the Hammer. And actually, I once interviewed Dion Dublin and got an exclusive that it was his debut on Homes Under the Hammer that day. And he was quite nervous about it airing and the sort of reaction he was going to get to being the new host, which feels like a really long time ago now. But yeah, I love Homes Under the Hammer. I would personally never get involved with flipping a property just because it's not my personal, I don't have a skill set, I don't think, that would make me a very good candidate at doing this. But that some people, you know, it's their profession, and quite often you see it on Homes Under the Hammer where that is actually what they do. You know, they might flip a property or two a year, and that's where they get their money from. But it's a risky business, Georgie, and you've got to know what you're doing. And I think a lot of people get sort of blindsided and think they can do it and then find all sorts of unknown things that crop up that they hadn't budgeted for, which is always those classic TV things. But what Hampton International is saying is that the average profit on flipping a property, which is defined as a property that is flipped and sold within 12 months, is up to £40,955 from £29,685. So that's the profits that they're saying from all this. But as I say, it's a kind of thing you've got to be aware of all of the pitfalls. So a rule of thumb is to aim for a minimum of profit of 20%, but that's because plenty can go wrong, sort of underestimating costs, dips in the market. And actually what you were alluding to there is obviously there's been a bit of a property mini boom in recent months, which has driven up prices. And again, people might be paying more than they might have been before. But a lot of these places are homes that have fallen into, you know, in desperate need of repair, and you kind of get a couple of different levels of it. You get one that just needs, you know, stripping out new carpets, you know, paint job, few new white appliances, that kind of thing. Then you get ones that need walls tearing down, they need damp proofing, they need you know, new foundations, they need central heating putting in, they need all of these bits and pieces. For me, as I say, I'm not very comfortable thinking about doing it. It actually fills me with dread thinking about owning a property like this that needs doing up and flipping. But there's someone we spoke to in the story, John Howard, who has done this more than 3,500 times. And his current advice to people that are tempted to do this is that buyers are currently paying top prices on the basis that the market will continue to grow. And then he goes on to add, I don't think that will happen. Which is a kind of a bit of a warning shot from him. But hey, maybe he just doesn't want anyone to muscle in on his territory. Who knows? But I reckon one person who could be interested in doing up a home that needs a bit of TLC is Mr. Lambert. I reckon he's got grand design visions. One day, I reckon he's going to take on a grand designs project.
But Simon, if that is you, I mean, Lee said there the average profit is 40,000, which is a very decent yearly wage. But actually, with house prices potentially overheating, as it were, the market overheating, there's lots of things that can go wrong. Is there like a tick list of things that you need to check when you go to an auction or you buy this property in disrepair and want to do it up? It sounds to me like something that would be great as a little side project to do, but to commit, if you're a first time person to doing it, would you, Simon? Would you leave it all? Please don't leave this as money, but you know, would you think about doing that as a full-time project?
The problem would be, as Lee said, my practical skills are not up to scratch. If I was someone who was much better at doing practical, you know, work, then maybe I would. For example, my cousin is a carpenter. I mean, he could do a great job of doing something like this. I've got a mate who, one of my school friends, who he is an exceptionally talented, practical person. He's worked as a craftsman. He actually does something completely different, but he is a very talented craftsman. And I'm pretty sure that if he turned his hand to renovating a property, he could renovate a property. Or it might be that it's your job. You know, you might be a plumber, an electrician, a builder, a tradesman, or whatever. It's going to be much easier to do it in that way because you're only paying yourself for quite a lot of it rather than paying someone else's wages. One of the problems at the moment is that it's actually really difficult to get your hands on people to do work for you. And in some very in-demand areas, they can literally pretty much name their price. Now, so once you get past that, you could just get other people to do it for you. And there are people who do this and turn it into a bit of a system. But there are some things that you need to consider, which is, firstly, the way to make it as tax friendly as possible is to buy that property and to move into it and live in it for to it actually genuinely be your home. And then you do it up and then you sell it. Otherwise, you're going to be paying capital gains tax. If it's considered that this is your trade, then there will be tax to pay. There might be capital gains tax, which you would have on a second property. There might be that you have to pay income tax on it, for example. The tax treatment isn't just as simple as, oh, well, I've said I'm living in it, so it's tax-free. I would also work on the basis that house prices aren't going to go up. If you want to do this, do not do it on the basis that you think house prices are going to go up 10% next year or something like that. In fact, work on the basis that, is it going to be profitable for you if house prices go down? Is it going to be profitable for you if house prices fall 10% next year? Because that's what might happen. And if you still think that you can do, then, you know, it's not a bad way to do it. And actually, it's a way to beat the market if you've got the skills and you budget very carefully and you not go into it with your eyes open and you work on the basis that you're always going to spend more money than you think and you have a contingency and all these other things. It is a way to climb the property ladder because you can add value. Because it doesn't matter where house prices go. If you buy somewhere that is not very nice, not so good, and you make it nicer and you can add more value in the eyes of a potential buyer than you have spent in labor and materials costs, then you will make a profit. The problem is that a lot of people think this is just, yeah, I could do that, that's easy. And they end up, you know, spending way too much money. They don't treat it as a business, or they do it with their own home and then they decide actually they quite like living there. And then all they've done is spent a load of money on an extension or whatever. But a lot of people don't really go into it with their eyes open. And you've also got to be aware of the fact that most people are doing this with borrowed money. And we've talked about the risks of borrowed money earlier in this program. And the crisis that befalls the high street in terms of you need to keep paying the interest on those debts can also befall the amateur home flipper who discovers that they are paying the mortgage on an empty property that is taking longer than they think to renovate, or that they can't sell, or when it comes to it, actually they can't sell it for as much as they thought they could, and they have to accept an offer that's £10,000-£20,000 less, and now they can't repay the debt, and so on and so on. So it's fraught with difficulty, but if you know what you're doing and you have the skill set, then maybe.
I'm never going to watch Homes Under the Hammer again and think that this is something I can do. I'm frightened just listening to you. I wouldn't even know where to start, for goodness sakes. Anyway, I'm going to finally move on to a letter from one of your readers. I was a little surprised, actually, that this is Money Reader sent this in. It's about pensions. I'm just going to read it. I've never had a pension, as I've always believed they're not worth the paper they're written on. My sister is pro-pension, and we had a heated discussion. This says a lot about their family. Anyway, about the pros and cons, but I really believe that I can get a better deal by saving my money in a savings account rather than let someone else invest my money. Am I right in thinking this? Lee, this reader surely has not been listening to our podcasts or reading your fine website.
I think it's one of those classic things that people are nervous about. You know, they hear the word pension and the shutters come down and they think about, you know, it's just don't want to think about it. It's one of those sort of topics where people go, oh my word, no, what's that? No, don't know. Like to see my money in a pot somewhere and I know what's happening with it and all that kind of thing. And it shows Steve gets asked questions via our readers of all manner of things, including what on earth is the point of a pension like this one? Now, it probably requires a whole podcast dedicated to it to really go into the detail. But the three things that Steve says, and I have to completely agree with him on all of these three points, are the tax advantages of having a pension versus, you know, an ordinary savings account. That is basically pensions tax relief. You know, when you get your salary and it comes up before tax, I mean, that's just a massive bonus of paying into a pension. Number two is your employer is likely to match what you are putting in, or they might even go further than that and put in extra. So you might pay in 5%, they might pay in 10%. I would just treat that as free cash, you know, that's been given to you. You're not going to get that in a savings or a different kind of an account, and a potential return from a pension over the long run versus over a savings account. We're at a time now where a bog standard savings rate, you're lucky if you're getting 0.5% on Easy Access. You're lucky if you're getting a percent fixing away your money for years. You know, you can argue differently from something like a stocks and shares ISA, it might be slightly different, or some sort of investing account. But that appears to me what the issue is with the pension in the first place, not keen on it going into kind of like investing in things and not having control over what those things are. And also there's other factors to think about in my mind as well. Something like, you know, we don't know what the future of state pension looks like. And should you just be relying on that in the future? It really, you need to, depending on your age, you need to be sitting down and thinking about how much is going into a pension pot, how much you need upon retirement age, which keeps on creeping higher and higher over the next few decades, will increase upwards. So all of these kind of things are just require a sit down on a quiet afternoon to really work out how you're going to have a comfortable retirement, and whether that is done via paying into your pension with your employer or it's something else. But for me, a pension is just a private pension is a no-brainer.
Yeah. Simon, same for you?
Yes, because, you know, as Steve said and as Lee said, there's a number of factors that involve people paying in extra money. The government gives you automatically 20% basic rate tax relief. So that's 25% extra on whatever you pay in. Your employer might match what you pay in. And then you get investment gains on not only the money you've put in, but the money that other people have put in. And if you compare that to what we were just talking about in terms of investing in property, buy to let, for example, the government will do the opposite. If you buy property, it will take money off you. It will take stamp duty off you. And if you buy a buy to let, it will take extra stamp duty off you. You know, obviously lots of people have made money on buy to let, but that's because they're leveraged. A lot of them are doing it on borrowed money. You can't do that with your pension, but you can get a substantial boost to the amount of money that's going in there. And the great disadvantage of a pension is you can't get at it until you're 55. The great advantage of a pension is that you can't get at it until you're 55. You know, and you know, Steve says at the end, one final thought: if you look at the people in retirement today who are enjoying a good standard of living, the large majority are those who went down the pension route. I doubt that many of them now wish they had opted out of pensions and had a go at investing, or simply left their money in a savings account instead. Mm.
All right. Thank you very much to you both. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. Or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join the debate and read the comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.